I'm Jim Stein from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, Wisconsin, and I'm here today to have a little discussion with Bob Harrington and with Harlan Krumholtz about the concept of, are we on too many drugs? We come to the heart meetings every year. We're so excited for the late-breaking clinical trials, many of which deal with pharmacotherapy and new drugs to help prevent or treat heart disease. And I oftentimes wonder, are we on too many? I just got off being on call in the CCU, and I had a 60-year-old man who came in on a low dose of a diuretic and a low dose of a statin, and he was on some pain medicine for his arthritis and a vitamin. And I sent him out on aspirin and clopidogrel and a fish oil and a statin and two different antihypertensive therapies and a host of other drugs. I can't imagine he's going to take all of them.
We know he's not going to.
So we already have data for that.
We got data on that.
And I can't imagine that every one of them is necessary. So why don't I first ask Harlan, you know, do all these drugs really work and do they work with each other?
Well, I think there are two levels of questions here. One is, are there drugs that we're using for which the evidence is really weak but yet have become very popular for a variety of reasons? The other is this larger picture. We did a study several years ago where we were looking at the number of medications that a heart failure patient would go home on. These were Medicare patients, and it was just remarkable. The average number of meds were something like 11 or 12. The average number of doses, if you included how many times they were taking the meds, were in excess of 20. There were some people who were on 30 medications, and somehow we lose track of it, you know, and we don't realize what would it be like to be home taking all these. So in this case, even if they all are doing something, in aggregate, it's impossible for someone to actually keep up with the regimen. So I think there's two things. One is, have we even put together a regimen that even a super person could keep up with and take? And the second is, are we giving things to people that actually we have very little confidence are doing anything for them?
So what are some of the drugs that you're concerned about in cardiology? Concerned that they really may not be helping all that much. Let's talk about acute coronary syndromes, heart failure, common disease states.
You know, I think there's a range of them that go from where I'm not confident that they're providing any benefit to the benefit is likely to be very small. But the ones that we've been talking about a lot lately have to do with the prevention area. And fenofibrate, I think, stands out as a drug that's had two negative trials, that is a $2 billion a year drug, and for which there's not really any evidence of its benefit. People talk about using fibrates to prevent pancreatitis and very high triglyceride levels. Of course, that's a very narrow band of individuals, but mostly people are giving it to affect HDL levels or triglyceride levels. And I think it should be incumbent for a $2 billion a year drug to have some evidence of trials of benefit. Similarly, niacin, there's a lot of discussion about lately. We're waiting for one more trial to come down the pike, but it's about $1 billion a year in prescribed medication. And the question is, can we afford this kind of expense and patients that kind of inconvenience on top of their other regimens when we really are lacking strong evidence of benefit?
Yeah, I agree. Bob, let me take that a little bit further. Okay. Since you designed a lot of these trials, you know, we know that aspirin works for acute coronary syndromes. We know about clopidogrel and other phenylpyridines. But why do we keep adding on? Can we substitute?
Substituting in a clinical trial is a lot harder design than adding on. And frankly, the add-on reason, I think, is why particularly first trials that are trying to gain regulatory approval, because we're now largely talking about regulatory approval trials in a therapeutic space, are a lot easier to do. It's a lot cleaner, right? You're saying you have A, B, both arms, now you're adding C or placebo. That's a much cleaner comparison in a clinical trial that's seeking regulatory approval. But there's no doubt you're right, Jim. One of the things we have to start doing is peeling away. Maybe A plus C is better than A plus B.
What do you think about a trial? You know, so we've got a patient-centered outcomes research mm-hmm. institute that's going to have some money for trials. What if there were an intervention that said, we're going to do a deep dive into, you know, a group of people who are on a lot of meds, and in the intervention group, we're going to try to get down to half the number of meds, and we're going to look at outcomes. But this isn't going to be your traditional design. I mean, is that possible?
I think it is possible. I think that we've not done a great job at looking. You know, we're doing all this based on population statistics, right? We're looking at what's the average effect of adding this to this population. My sense, Harlan, is that we should start peeling things away and looking at different combinations. And we should also try to identify, are there markers of certain patients who would more likely, let's take the heart failure. Are there patients who are more likely to benefit from beta blockers and some patients who are more likely to benefit from ACE inhibitors? My hypothesis is maybe there are. And can we try to figure that out and peel things away?
So for the clinician whose patient now says, look, I'm eating a whole meal three times a day just on pills alone, do I really have to stay on aspirin since I'm already on clopidogrel? Do I really need to stay on a beta blocker because 2 years ago I had the heart attack, I take good care of myself, my EF is normal? What are some of the candidates you think that we could even start thinking about peeling away today?
I would love, you know, the antithrombotic area is, you know, one that I've worked in a lot, and I think we do need to start peeling things away. If you look at all the recent trials where we've gone from one to two to three agents, what have we done? We've gone from bleeding to more bleeding to more bleeding.
Right.
And there's got to be a way to start peeling things away, and maybe it's at a period of time. I mean, do you need your clopidogrel forever?
Right.
I don't know the answer to that. There is a trial going on, at least in the stent patients, is going to look to see how long you might need to be on it. If you don't tolerate aspirin well, maybe clopidogrel is enough. We do have a randomized comparison of clopidogrel versus aspirin.
Right.
In fact, clopidogrel won,
right.
And yet we still stack them up. I do think we should start peeling them back.
Well, and there are two, again, sound like a theme here, but there are two issues I think to consider. There's a group of medications that are intended to make people feel better. And then there may be a group of medications that we're giving that actually are intended to prevent adverse future events. And I think a lot of the things we're giving people to feel better, because we're not used to doing N-of-1 trials or people have never really been tried, we can't differentiate the placebo effect from the real effect of the medications. And we got to get better at trying to understand, actually, what are these medications doing for people in terms of making them feel better and maybe deciding what the best regimen is for that quality of life. On the preventive side, I think it's really important that we're able to talk to our patients so that they understand what is the magnitude of the benefit of all of these medications individually and then maybe together, because we should be having conversations and deciding together about what the regimen should look like, I think. And the more it is that they walk in and we say, you know, based on what you've seen, I'm just giving you a bunch of scripts,
yeah,
there's this disconnect. People don't really understand how all these things connect with how they feel and how long they're going to live. And I think that's why they tend to give up both that cost, inconvenience, it all comes together. But they don't feel a compelling need like, oh, you know, these are the two meds based on what you've told me that I really want to make sure I take, you know. And this really plays out with regard in stenting, you know, whether or not people really understand the issue about stent thrombosis and what that acute risk is. And I just think most patients are perplexed by all the medications.
I think it's us as perplexed as
yeah,
well. I mean,
yeah,
we think
true.
About this a lot, and I'll bet you go to see any of the patients that the three of us see, and they're on multiple medicines. And it's hard to.
Well, it's sometimes easier in a fast office-paced practice. You just,
right,
just want to check the box. And the
right.
quality indicators may not be helping us in this way because we're getting pressure. Every quality indicator is almost looking singularly. Are you doing this? Are you doing that? Are you doing
right.
this? Instead of looking holistically at the patient, and that can sometimes cause a problem.
You know, the free MI study, which I've brought up a few times this week, it remains one of my favorite studies of the last year, where they randomized, you know, in a cluster way to providing free medicines, no copay, or just having your copay for ACE, ARBs, beta blockers, and statins. And there were a couple things in that trial that struck me. First off, 10% of people at a year were taking all three.
Right.
Secondly, when you give it free, you still don't get 100% adherence, not anywhere close to that, but you do get a little bit of a bump, 4-5-6% absolute more than if you have to pay for them. And that little bit of a bump did translate into a benefit.
Right. I mean, it tells us that taking pills really is a psychological experience. It's not just a financial experience.
Yeah.
So two more questions. Are you aware of any research that's looked at the incremental benefits of drugs, say in heart failure or for ACS patients? You know, it's easy when we say a new drug reduces mortality. It's an easy sell. But has anyone done any modeling and looked at how much more you get adding the beta blocker to the ACE inhibitor, adding the spironolactone to the other cocktail, members of the cocktail?
You only have what the trials had. So that in Rawls, for example, or Ephesus, you did have optimal therapy with the treatments that had been used up to that time, and then this is
right.
the add-on. But you don't. That's why all the beta blocker trials, you pretty much are confident adding them to an ACE inhibitor, you get something.
Right.
What you don't know is, what if you went beta blocker first? What would happen?
I mean, this was a big dilemma with the 2B3 inhibitors, right? So
right.
the 2B3 inhibitors came onto the scene when it was aspirin plus heparin.
Right.
Then late on the scene came the ADP blockers. And I think the guideline writers struggled for years with, what do you do if you're already on an ADP blocker? Do you really need a 2B3 inhibitor? Or vice versa, if you've been started on the 2B3 inhibitor, what was the advantage of adding an ADP blocker?
And nobody wants to repeat the trials.
Nobody wants to repeat
And the it. Early trials were industry trials. They got the indication. They're not going to put themselves at risk. The government says, you've already got trials.
Done deal.
And so then we were stuck with really no... And I think the guidelines reflect that over the years, where they seem to struggle with that particular issue. And so some of the modeling I think people do, how much incremental benefit, but a lot of it is just that, it's modeling.
So in our last couple of minutes, let's put our brains together and think about what are some of the leading candidates for studies to look at withdrawal or not starting? Is it aspirin? Is it beta blockers in ACS? Digoxin? I think we've done DIG.
There are a lot of people still on DIG.
There are still a lot of people on it. But you know, what about doing an ACS study and omitting aspirin, or a coronary disease study and omitting beta blockers?
Could you do it ethically?
You know, this has always been a challenge. We talked, I think, off camera about the TRACER trial. Right. And I've been asked, you know, why did you add Vorapaxar to aspirin plus clopidogrel? Trying to take clopidogrel away from ACS doctors who have just stented their patients right. is a very difficult task. Right. TRACER, I think, would have been a much better study if we had randomized people to the triple therapy versus two types of dual.
It might have even done better. Right. I'll give you an example, one that is tugging at me, which is, and I was responsible for this quality measure with a lot of others, that's beta blocker discharge after MI. Right. You know, it's based on data that was right. published in 81.
Old data.
So in that data, no PCI, CABG is excluded, or there were very few.
Much greater ischemic burden.
Younger patients yep. and much greater ischemic burden. It's an entirely different era, and yet we haven't repeated that trial. So shouldn't we repeat that study?
I agree.
And see if people really need to be on beta blockers. We're just in a session where someone said, of course, everyone after MI needs to be on beta blockers.
So based on what?
I'm thinking based on what?
And they have some downsides, right? They make people tired. They cause some derangements of insulin glucose metabolism, changes in HDL and triglycerides. I wonder how much my patient with a normal EF who's been stented, who's gone through rehab, and is on appropriate secondary prevention really needs
that
drug.
And we're not seeing the arrhythmias that we saw
Absolutely.
30 years ago.
Because you don't have the big infarct. Right. And you don't have the ischemia.
It's
the
an entirely
ischemia
different
still,
clinical
still
experience.
Residual.
Okay, so who's going to fund us?
Well, it's tough, right? This is a big issue, for example, in non-inferiority trials, because in non-inferiority, you make some certain assumptions. There's the historical assay assumption, where you're assuming that things have been done roughly the same over time. There's the constancy assumption that, you know, is in fact the effect of A versus B or A versus placebo the same now as it would have been back then. So there's a lot of things that this plays into that it's easy to say pull them away, but what does that mean as you're going to the next study? You have to study it.
But if we can get by the IRB, I think we can get, there will be places interested in funding. I think NIH.
It would be a great PCORI.
PCORI, Patient-Centered yeah. Outcomes Research Institute. I'm on the board, so I'm not going to be part of the trial, but bring together some people and ask some good questions.
I think it would be great in heart failure to really think about the different combinations, because 11 medicines, come
right.
on.
Right. Yeah, heart failure and ACS. Well, it was a great discussion. Thanks for joining me this afternoon, and thanks to everyone for listening. Maybe you can design some trials too.